Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here at WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you today, Sunday, March 19th, 2006, with my guest, Professor Cindy Adachajua, Professor of African American Studies and History at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, Director of the African American Studies Program, if I'm not mistaken, author of many articles and the book, America's First Black Town, Brooklyn, Illinois, 1830 to 1950, published by University of Illinois Press in 2000, and also one of the sponsors of the big conference coming up on the University of Illinois campus in just 2 weeks, March 30th to April 1st, Race, Roots, and Resistance, Revisiting the Legacies of Black Power.
Actually, Bob, the conference is going to start on March 29th. We got so many abstracts and submittals that we decided to go ahead and add an evening. So we'll open with an address by Vincent Franklin, who is the editor of the Journal of African American History. And this talk should be quite interesting. It's called Jackanapes, a bridge between black power and the hip-hop movement. So essentially it's going to be a critique of gangster rap in a lot of ways. But this conference, we think it's going to be the major event in black studies nationally. We've got already 200 registrants from outside the university. People are still registering. We're anticipating somewhere in the neighborhood of 500-600 people coming in.
500-600 people from around the country?
Yeah.
That's
very and international.
Who are some of the other key main speakers that will be there?
Our major keynote is Kathleen Cleaver, who I think everyone knows.
For the sake of some of our younger listeners.
Kathleen Cleaver, she was the former Black Panther Party leader who was at one time married to Eldridge Cleaver, the Minister of Information. She's now a law school professor at Emory, and in one of those weird bi-coastal kind of things. She's, well, not, I guess it's not bi-coastal, it's up the coast. She's also a professor of African and African American Studies at Yale.
All right. And she'll be giving, what day is her speech going to be?
Her keynote is that Friday, which would be the 31st.
31st of March. And all of this will be in the Illini Union, and if someone goes there, it'll be real easy to find out where everything is.
All of the the plenary talks and the concurrent sessions will be at the Illini Union, with the exceptions of the first talk by VP Franklin will be at Levis Center. But we've also mixed in a number of artistic kinds of things. So, for example, there will be two films shown, and those films will be shown at Cranford Art Museum. We also have a photo exhibit. Eugene Redmond, internationally known poet, but also he's one of those guys who always had a camera. Mm-hmm. So going back into the mid-60s forward, this guy was constantly clicking away. So he's got a major photo exhibit on the Black Arts Movement that's touring, and we were fortunate to get it here. That will be at Cranford Art. And there's also a concert. Actually, two concerts at Cranford Art that will also take place. So we tried to involve a wide range of other institutions and organizations on campus in this activity.
Cindy Adachajua, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Cindy Adachajua is the professor of history and African American studies here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and is an author of numerous articles on politics, African American politics, and history. And we've got a lot to talk about. And I think let's start really, if we can, talk about the Black Power movement. I mean, just generally what, and we've got a lot of young listeners, and I think you teach enough young people to know that this question's not as naive as it might sound. You know, what was the Black Power movement? Why is it important to understand?
Well, you know, first, let's talk about what it wasn't. To try and provide some context, Black Power as a social movement has tended to be vilified or erased from history, so that what people focus on is the civil rights movement, and they tend to think of civil rights as having been this nonviolent movement based on moral suasion that actually led to the transformation, the ending of segregation, when in fact Black Power played an equally, if not a greater role in the ending of that old form of racial oppression. So when we think about Black Power, essentially It's a movement for community control. It's a movement for the building of autonomous African-American institutions. It's a movement for creating one could call African-Americanized spaces inside white organizations. So, for example, Black Studies is a result, a consequence of the Black Power movement because it deals with questions of identity, consciousness, the importance of the connection to Africa, those kinds of things that were not on the radar of the civil rights movement.
The civil rights movement, I mean, in popular lexicon, was launched in the mid-1950s and, right. and peaked or sort of hit its peak by the early 1960s to mid-1960s. Does the Black Power movement come later or simultaneously? How would you put those two together?
I would agree with your time frame that the civil rights movement, in fact, does begin with the Montgomery bus boycott. And so at some point in the mid-1960s, you begin to see elements of Black Power, and some of these elements stretch back in time because Black Power is essentially a form of African-American nationalism. So some of these, some of the ideas that Black Power would, in fact, coalesce and emerge and congeal into the concept that we came to know as Black Power go back into the 1890s, go back to the Garvey movement and forward. So probably a fruitful way to think of it is that Black Power is a movement that at a particular moment comes out of the civil rights movement, right? Mm-hmm. It's a response to both the failures, or I should say the qualified success yeah. of the civil rights movement, but it has its own ideologies, its own discourses, its own symbols and practices, leaders, organizations, etc. So I think it's best to think of it as something that begins to emerge out of civil rights movement in the mid-60s and then continues after what I would think would be the end of the civil rights movement. I think the death of Martin Luther King definitively ends the civil rights movement because those sets of the legislation, the successful litigation, basically ends in the late '60s after King's death, and after that point, we begin to see a reversal mm-hmm. of those laws of et cetera.
Now, King himself, do you think that in the last year or two of his life, he in a way was sort of moving beyond the traditional civil rights agenda too? It seemed like he was taking up, like he was in Memphis, for example, to be at a worker strike to support the municipal workers in Memphis.
You know, King is an extremely interesting figure who, I guess in the scholarship, the complexity of King is captured at least for the '60s, right? But if you go back into the late '50s, you will find that the kinds of concerns that King began to voice around the Vietnam War and around poverty, he was articulating in 58, 59. Mm-hmm. I think what happens is that the United States is such a repressive place for progressive ideas that King had to kind of mask, cover over, and become silent around those questions. But we begin to see post-1965 that those concerns that had earlier animated mm-hmm. King's ideas, he I begins see. To pick those things back up. And in some way, you could think that what Black Power really does is that it creates space for the real King yeah. to emerge.
Well, what was the Black Power movement then that emerges, say, in 64, 65, 66? What were the key themes? Who were some of the key players in it?
Key players would, of course, be Stokely Carmichael, who eventually changed his name to Kwame Ture, who, when he became the leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, which I think we would have to argue was the cutting edge of the civil rights movement. It was the most visionary, particularly in terms of progressive ideas. It was the most democratic in terms of its practices, in that SNCC workers sought not so much to lead as to develop leadership amongst grassroots people. So when Kwame Ture becomes leader of SNCC, that's at the time when it flips toward Black Power. The Congress of Racial Equality, which had been a fairly old civil rights organization, formed in 42, but reaches its peak post-55, of course, after Montgomery. At this time, it has a new leader as well, Floyd McKissick, who is one of the really unsung heroes, but also a very complicated figure. And I just want to kind of go off on McKissick for a moment. I'm currently researching a book on Floyd McKissick. McKissick is a black nationalist, or he becomes a black nationalist in the mid-60s. He wants to build a middle-class all-black town in North Carolina that he calls Soul City. In order to accomplish this, he cuts a deal with Richard Nixon and later Gerald Ford, where they give him something like $25, $26 million to start this town. In exchange, well, maybe it's not as crass as that. Mm-hmm. This might be my cynicism coming out. Yeah. He converts to becomes a Republican and begins to support Nixon and later Ford. And I would argue that in that move that McKissick makes, we begin to see the genesis of a new relationship between black nationalists and the Republican Party that leads to the formation of a kind of black conservatism. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what makes McKissick both interesting and extremely important. Of course, I don't agree with the moves he makes, but he's a central figure because he comes to represent a more conservative stream of black power.
Because black power, I think, is traditionally associated with the political left.
Right, which is a grave error.
In the case of McKissick and otherwise,
in the case
too.
Of McKissick and in case of the dominant stream of black power, the dominant stream of black power is a kind of mainstream liberal ethnic pluralism. Mm-hmm. And so it's about electing people of your national group with the hope that they will, in fact, represent the interests of the majority of that population.
So it's a very strong identity politics, you say, and by using contemporary terminology.
You know, Bob, I've always kind of cringed with that notion because what it assumes is that people, let us say African-Americans, were really dumb enough to vote for someone just on the basis of skin color and take positions based on skin color. I think what we're talking about, when we talk about race in this country, we're talking about a social relationship, and it's a relationship that has certain interests and, you know, real material concrete forms of living. Mm-hmm. So that what's generally called identity, I think, is better to think about as interests, right? Now, of course, there's a way to talk about types of consciousness that come out of that aspect. But so I would argue that what black power came to do was to represent a kind of politic that was in the interest of African-American people generally, right? But black power is a very broad concept because it had to be broad to capture, it becomes the dominant aspect of a social movement. It eclipses the civil rights movement, it eclipsed people as prominent and as powerful and influential in the black community as Martin Luther King. So to do that, it had to be broad and appeal to a wide range of people. So what you find in black power is essentially four kinds of currents or streams of thought. So on the one hand, there's this dominant liberal mainstream ethnic pluralism that that all ethnic groups or racialized communities try to function in this society. Then on the left, there's a very radical revolutionary nationalist and that would at some point develop a Marxist wing. On the right, there's the kind of stuff that McKissick is doing around economic development. There's a whole slew of people in CORE, Roy Ennis, who push black power in a very rightward direction, right? And then there's another broad stream that's cultural nationalist. And cultural nationalism is hard to identify in the ways that we've categorized these other currents politically. Cultural nationalism can run the gambit, but it's about identity. If we want to say that there's an element that's strongly focused on identity, and it's about the transformation of identity, because remember, there's this dramatic change in name, right? Before the Black Power era, the people we now know as African Americans were commonly referred to as Negroes, right? Post Black Power, they're known as Black. And to some extent, that's taking a phrase, a term, a nomenclature that had been really derided and seen as a negative in this society. To call somebody black in the early 60s was to prepare for a fight.
Really?
Right?
I didn't know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, well, think about it. How could it not? If you think about the ways in which this society waged war on blackness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you just do simple things like open up a dictionary,
mm-hmm.
every meaning for black is negative.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Right? And so obviously in that context then, all of the references in a school system toward being black are going to be negative.
Yeah.
So people, that's what they're going to learn,
mm-hmm.
right? Whenever the word is used, it's going to be used with intense emotion in a deriding way. So that transformation to reach back, take the concept black, right,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then invert it and pour into it positive meanings and connect it to the continent of Africa. That's, you know, that's one of the most powerful things that Black Power did, is that it rehabilitated the image and the identity and the self-consciousness of African-American people. And with that came a whole host of cultural changes, everything from dress, right, to wearing of African clothes. But even at a more profound level, an organization that I normally don't have a lot of good things to say about, the Nation of Islam, right?
Mm-hmm.
In their movement toward blackness, they also put an emphasis on dietary reform.
Mm-hmm.
Their concept was to throw out the slave master's diet.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think about the concept of what's happened today, right, obesity running rampant in the African-American community, that in the Black Power era, there were strong movements against this kind of thing, rooted on a notion of naturalism becoming more natural, da-da-da-da.
Mm-hmm.
So the point is, say, that Black Power transformed every aspect of African Americans' lives in the sense of individual, family, community, but it also transformed the relationship to the U.S. in far more profound ways than civil rights. That's why Harold Barron makes the argument that Black Power, second to emancipation, are the most transformative events in African American experience.
I certainly can't disagree with that, being 53 years old and having lived through the Black Power period as a teenager in my early 20s and knowing what a profound experience that had in everyone in this country
right.
at that time. My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters here in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois, coming to you this Sunday, March 19th, 2006. This show is with Professor Sundiata Chajua, Professor of African American Studies and History at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Excuse me. And it is being pre-recorded a few days before we went on air, so please do not call in today. Just sit back and let the professors do the yakking. We're talking about Black Power, which is going to be the subject of a major national conference here on the University of Illinois campus starting March 29th and through April 1st. Information about this can be found. Where would people go, Sundiata, if they wanted to?
They could go to our website.
It's got like 800 characters. It's not a quick version, is there?
Yeah, I guess www.aasrpuiuc.edu.
Yeah, and then you can click, you'll see the links, yeah. But I think if you go to the AASRP, which is the African American Studies
Research Program
at the UIUCEDU website, which is standard, you ought to be beside the links to this conference. It is a major to-do. It will be taking place. And we're talking about the significance on the show today of Black Power historically and for the present day and what the point of the conference is. And generally, I think we're talking about Black Power in politics in the United States in general, too. We've been talking about as I recall from my anecdotal personal experience coming of age, was from, say, 65 or so until the early 70s, I would characterize from my experience as the high water of the Black Power movement. I mean, as a scholar, how would you demarcated the civil rights movement as ending in April 1968 with the assassination of Martin Luther King.
But, Bob, you and I both know that when the beginning of one thing and the end of another, they don't necessarily have to coincide.
That's
right. There's a transition period. I would say that Black Power really does emerge post 66.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the movement maintains its vitality up through about 75, 76. I mean, I think a fruitful way to think about it, right, is that if we were doing a history of the Black Panther Party, for example.
Mm-hmm. Is that sort of considered a key part of the Black Power movement?
definitely, but of the left wing of it, absolutely, absolutely. The Panthers in the mid-70s, that's the period from 69 to about 72, when the federal government is violating the Constitution. Local governments are assassinating Panther leaders. They're trying to smash the party, illegally framing people, putting individuals in jail, et cetera. So that lets us know that it moves, that it does survive past 70. And I think that we can see some of the activities of groups like the African Liberation Support Committee, the Move Toward Pan-Africanism, that these groups remain viable up through 74, 75. And I think if we take the Bakke decision of 1976.
That's the affirmative action decision.
That's right. The anti-affirmative action
decision. Yeah, the Supreme Court's decision.
That I think we can think of that as a kind of end point for black power.
Okay. And, well, let's go through sort of a little more before we talk about the present day and the conference. Again, I think the Black Panthers jump out as a group that people associate with black power. You said they were sort of the left portion of the movement or the militant wing.
In the sense that one of the important things about the Panthers, you know, one of the arguments one would make is this. Look, black power launches coalitional politics in the sense of the notion of the rainbow coalition, unification of people of color and white radicals around a common agenda. The Panthers are one of the first groups to make that kind of move by forming alliances with the Peace and Freedom Party, the Young Lords, the Brown Berets, and various Asian American groups. So this common notion of multiracialism, right, comes out of black power. The Panthers aren't the only group to make that move. Even groups that are traditionally seen as narrow nationalist, quote-unquote, black separatist groups, such as the US organization out of Los Angeles, led by Maulana Karenga. If you actually look at their history, they formed a number of alliances with other people of color, and that was central to their organizing mission. So part of what's happened is that black power has been painted as this separatist movement, when in fact it was the most inclusive of the movements. It sought to build the broadest wave of alliances, you know, different wings of it, right?
Well, you know, we were talking before we went on air and started taping today's show about some of your research, which deals with the nadir of the African-American politics and what happened in the 1880s and early 20th century. And you were saying that, you know, that's I don't want to put words in your mouth, but just from the title of your paper, from what I know, a period which has traditionally been considered an extraordinarily racist period in American history.
Absolutely.
Of the almost unprecedented attacks on African Americans and, you know, a period of retrenchment for African American rights and freedoms across the country. And then you made a comparison to the period since 1980 to that period. Could you talk a little about both those periods?
Yeah. I think the best way to do that is to first talk about the periods of progressive reform and transformation. So that on the one hand, I think most listeners have heard about Reconstruction. And we know that that's a moment in which African-American men, right, gain the right to vote. African-Americans become citizens and their rights are enshrined in the 14th Amendment, right? That is a period where you get the first wave of a large number of black politicians elected
to
office.
This is 1865 to the mid-1870s.
1865 to the mid-1870s, right? And we can talk about a number of other positive reforms that emerge out of Reconstruction. But the point ultimately is that these white terrorists, the Redeemers, the Southern plantation owners, come in and they smash Reconstruction. The Northern troops are pulled out. Writers and scholars generally compare Reconstruction to the Civil Rights Movement. And they refer to the Civil Rights Movement as the Second Reconstruction. For our purposes, we can refer to the Civil Rights and Black Power movements as the Second Reconstruction. Right. So the question is, what came after the first Reconstruction is the nadir. The nadir is a term that simply means the abyss, the lowest of the low. Rayford Logan, the great African-American historian from Howard University, argued that the nadir was the lowest point in, we'll quote his terminology, the Negro struggle for freedom. If we go through and we look at that period, right, one of the things we find is that from 1875 on, there is an attempt to nullify, to reduce the significance of the 15th Amendment and the 14th Amendment.
And for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with our Constitution that well, 14th Amendment is the amendment that requires that the civil rights in the first 10 amendments of the Constitution apply to all states as well as the federal government.
And to all citizens, regardless of race, color, creed, religion, right? 15th Amendment is the right to vote.
Yeah.
And so there's a strong move to nullify those rights. So one example would be 1890, the Mississippi State Constitution denies blacks the right to vote. All right, and the way they do that is by putting in place what we'll call disfranchising amendments. So you get the poll tax, property qualification, literacy test. And what these things do, you know, there's stories as late as the 1960s of African-American with doctorates not being able to pass the literacy test because they give you an article in Chinese, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a story that they happened to give it to the wrong African-American, someone who could read Chinese. but you had to always interpret it to
the satisfaction.
The person
giving the test wouldn't read Chinese
either,
though.
Right, he couldn't read Chinese, of course not. Yeah. But you still would have to interpret whatever you were given to the satisfaction of the poll judge, so you never met that criteria, right? And so we could go on and on. We could point to a number of things, you know, that moved to roll back those rights. But those aren't just legal moves. Right? This is also a moment of profound, extraordinary violence. So, you know, I study lynchings. If you take the decade 1890 to 1900, right? If you lived during that period, every 2.5 days, you would look on the front page of a newspaper and some African American man, woman, or child would have been lynched, right? So during that decade, every 2.5 days, a black person was lynched somewhere in the country. 95% of lynchings in the South. So this is a period of extraordinary violence, and we can go through a number of other factors that Logan talked about that made this period, mm-hmm. right, 1877 to 1917, the nadir.
Yeah.
Well, my analysis is that if we look at the period from 1980, Ronald Reagan's ascension, right? Mm-hmm. One of the first things that happens is a move to reverse or to weaken civil rights legislation. Now, one of the things that's curious, you know, all these people who praise Ronald Reagan, this is a man, right? One of the first places he went during his campaign for president was Philadelphia, Mississippi.
The first.
Yeah. That's right. You would know that, Bob. Yeah. You're on the media. The first place he went was Philadelphia, Mississippi. Yeah. And you say, where the hell, what is Philadelphia, Mississippi? It only holds one significance in U.S. history. It is the place where the three civil rights workers, Goodwin, Cheney, and Swerner, were murdered. So why would Reagan go to Philadelphia, Mississippi? And what did he say when he was there? He said that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was unconstitutional and that the Voting Rights Act was a bad piece of legislation. And he carried out his presidency in that manner. In other words, the aim was to reverse those civil rights laws and the practices that have been put in place, affirmative action, etc. And my argument would be that if we begin to look at what develops and what emerges, and we choose your category, right? And we can show that it looks similar to the first nadir, right? So that we had these two moments of progressive reform and a struggle toward multiracial democracy, and then we have those movements put down through violence, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then coming out of that, the black movement is weakened, the associated alliances and those movements are not as strong, and we get a strong drift to the right. We see the same thing. If we were to, for example, if you were to pull up the data on African-American income in relationship, median income of black families in relationship to white families, right? And you were to pull it up for this contemporary moment, what you're going to find is that it looks like the percentages in the late 50s, 59 to be exact, right? You could take a number of other social indicators, and what you're going to find is that they look like, in relationship to whites, like the data in the late 50s, early 60s, i.e. before the successes of the civil rights movement, that these things have been rolled back in terms of material conditions, right? And what happens is that the media likes to do two things. One, they want to focus on the few Oprah and Robert Johnsons of the world. And two, they then want to read the plight of impoverished blacks as reflection of their personal moral behavior.
Yeah, standard text.
Right? Yeah, standard text. They do it for poor whites as well, you know, standard text. But the point is that
if you don't make it, you're a loser.
That's right. You somehow it's your own personal fault, even though there are hundreds of millions of people in that same plight, right? My point is that if you look at the data, you look at those relationships, we can argue that there's a new nadir. And we see it on the level of policy. We see it in terms of income. We see it in terms of wealth. We see it particularly in terms of education, right? The schools are as segregated today as they were in the early 60s.
And we're talking to Sundi Adichajewa today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to here on WILL AM 580. Sundi Adichajewa is a professor of history and African-American studies here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And he is one of the co-sponsors, along with various academic units on campus, of a major national conference on black power coming up March 29th to April 1st here at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, titled Race, Roots, and Resistance, Revisiting the Legacies of Black Power. So I think you can tell from this show, this is an extraordinarily important and fascinating topic, one of interest to all of us. And I hope everyone in the community will take part in it and participate in the conference and attend the sessions that are there. This is a pre-recorded show. We taped it a few days before going on air so I could head off to the Northland over spring break and do some research for future episodes of Media Matters. So please don't call in today. Let Professor Chajua and myself do the yakking. On that last point, excuse me, Sundiata, I was just reading an interview with Lonnie Guinier, who's got a new book coming out next year on meritocracy. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It looks like it's going to be a sort of a major critique of a lot of these issues we're talking about.
I await that book.
Yeah. And one of the points she made in the interview that was quite striking relates to this, which is that in this country, we conflate race and class a lot, or don't conflate it. I mean, we don't have a very sophisticated understanding of it. And so those statistics you just referred to, which refer to African Americans and how their situation in 2006 economically and inequality relationship to non-African Americans is similar to 1959. If you look at just purely on economic terms, if you look on class terms, it's also a similar situation. What we've seen, you know, was tremendous growth in equality between 1945 Absolutely. And 1970. And since 1970, we've seen this massive widening. So even if you just look in class terms, that's also a true issue as well.
No, absolutely. I mean, you know, I would, of course, link it to the neoliberal policies, expansion of global capital, and that this general trend, right, because it's not just a U.S. trend, it's a world trend, right, from the 70s on, of the gap between working class and elites has expanded. I think I saw something that I read by Michael Parenti, where in the 70s, the average CEO made something like 70 times what the average worker makes.
You know, it's like 700 billion times.
Yeah, it's like 326.
Yeah, it's like unbelievable.
Right now. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's just,
it's off the charts.
How do you fathom it?
Yeah.
But also, this is, you know, race and class and how you disengage them is a very difficult thing. But one of the things we can show is that while there has been some shrinkage between the gap between the black middle class and the white middle class, right? One of the things that we can consistently show is that the wealth differential remains extraordinarily wide. We can even show that you take the average income of a white person with a high school education, a white male, right? Mm-hmm. They still tend to make more than a black person with a BA. Hmm. And so when we start looking at those kinds of factors, then we know that it's not just class, but it also has a racial inflection.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
The issue of politics with the Black Power Movement, and you've talked about the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. This is a recurring issue, and it is today as well, with advancing political interest through the party system in the United States. I mean, what were the politics of the Black Power Movement, to the extent we can even put them, categorize them, vis-a-vis the Republicans and Democrats, besides Floyd McKissick, in the late 60s and early 70s? How did they, because let me preface this by saying I recall the famous line of Eldridge Cleaver in the 68 presidential race, when his analysis of it in one sentence was, this was a race between Tweedledee and Tweedledum, and Tweedledum won.
Yeah, yeah. There are a lot of great lines that came out of that era, wasn't
yeah.
it? Again, you have a mixture of things, but the broad cutting edge was what one would call independent Black politics, right? So on the one hand, there was a move to build a national independent Black political party, right? There was a move to build, at the local level, grassroots parties. And we can see this phenomena in terms of the local Black autonomous political party. Excuse me. You can see it in Lowndes County. You can see it in Detroit, on and on. But you also see, in the sense of ethnic politics, you see mainly Democratic Party Black politicians,
mm-hmm.
right, recognizing that their expansion. Okay, well, let me put this in context. Right, context. 1964. There are, in the entire country, from dog catcher to president, 104 African Americans holding political office. Okay, by the time we get to 1975, we've got more than 3,500. That explosion, right, comes out of Black Power.
Sure.
Right. Now, those politicians are mainly being elected on a Democratic banner. In the initial stage, I would argue that before the money becomes so dominant, right, those politicians tried to serve their constituency. So one of the things we see, major event, 1972, the Gary Convention.
Mm-hmm.
And what's important about Gary is that one could think of it as
you should probably let our listeners know what the Gary Convention
was.
Yeah. Good, because this is...
Yeah. The Gary Convention is a political convention of African Americans that's held in Gary, Indiana. Richard Hatcher had become the first Black mayor of that overwhelmingly African American city, and it's a convention that brings together three strands in African American politics. Actually, a few more than that, but it brings in mainstream politicians, that group of liberal pluralists that we talked about, who see Black Power as a vehicle for political power. It brings in Black nationalists, and it brings in a set of Blacks further to the left. And they coalesce in Gary, and they come up with a Black agenda. And what's interesting about that agenda is that you've got state delegations. I mean, there's probably 5,000 people at this thing, right? And it's a year or two long process of state delegations, holding community-based meetings, getting a sense from the masses of African-American people of what they want,
mm-hmm.
right? So they put this agenda together, and the I can't remember everything about the agenda, but this phrase that's part of the preamble remains very salient, right? And the phrase is, we have no permanent political enemies, no permanent political friends. What we have are a permanent set of interests,
mm-hmm.
right? And that was an approach that I think did live during that period, right, before it shut down, that really did say, Democrats, Republicans, whoever else, we have an agenda based on the needs and the interests of our people,
mm-hmm.
and we negotiate that. That's not a possibility now,
mm-hmm.
Because what happened is that this is at a moment before the Republican Party becomes this bastion of right wing, what could one say
yeah,
about well. It and remain civil?
Yeah.
So at that moment, you could negotiate with the liberal wing of the Republican Party, the Nelson Rockefellers,
in fairness to the Republican Party, or in accuracy, if not fairness isn't the right term, just being accurate, prior to the Goldwater ascension in 1964 in the northern states and in the southern actually too, the Republicans were as sympathetic on civil rights issues in many cases as the Democrats
were.
That's right. And certainly
in the
South more so.
That's right. And in fact, one of the things that made it easy for McKissick to cut that deal is that in North Carolina, where he was from, blacks often, when they could try and run in the early 60s, they did it on the Republican banner.
Sure.
Because the South, of course, was a solid Democratic white racist South.
Jackie Robinson was a noted Republican, I think, for precisely that reason. And Nixon got one-third of the black vote in 1960.
That's right. And Nixon in 1960, from the standpoint of racial politics, deserved one-third of the vote. Kennedy wasn't that much better.
Yeah.
It may not have been better. Remember, affirmative action is Richard Nixon's creation.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy may have used the phrase, may have put some machinery in work. Johnson may have tweaked it. But it is Richard Nixon who put in goals and timetables.
Well, let's jump ahead today, Cindy Adachajua, and talk about the state of African-American politics in the U.S. in current times. Are we still in the nadir, or are we approaching the end of it? I mean, where do you see the current situation?
Deep in the nadir.
Deep in the nadir. Oh, man, so you're not an optimist.
I'm a realist.
Okay.
I mean, on what basis would one be optimistic looking at the current state of things? African-American politics has shifted to where the emphasis is too much on the side of electoral politics. And this isn't a situation where African-Americans can really control who they vote for, because the money pours in. And when the money and the organization pours in, you find things like outstanding black politicians who, took very courageous positions being defeated. Because of the role of money.
Cynthia McKinney, of course. The Georgia member of Congress, who, for those who admired her, she did get elected
again.
She came back and won.
Right.
But she paid a steep price.
But she wasn't the only one. And what it revealed that moment is that progressive black politicians are vulnerable. If you take the Democratic Party, it would be fair to say that a person like Harold Ford,
the Tennessee representative, fairly conservative, pro-business.
Fairly conservative? You're so nice. Harold Ford is absolutely working against the best interests of African-American people.
Yeah.
But he represents a trend that has become very powerful inside African-American politics. And if we look on the outside, which is where we ultimately have to look, because it's always been the social movement that has laid the basis for progressive social change and created the space for mainstream politicians to do the right thing, so to speak, right?
Sure.
The movement has been in disarray since the late 70s. It has not really recovered. When you get the kind of economic devastation that wrecked urban areas from the time Reagan reallocated budget slash. And I know a lot of it has to do with deindustrialization, but a lot of it has to do with neoliberal policies, things that politicians had choices.
Sure. I mean, Sweden has had its deindustrialization too, but its working class hasn't been devastated.
That's right. That's right. And it's not just the devastation economically, but it's also the pursuit of social policies that target and demean African Americans. So you get, one of the statistics that's always stuck in my mind is that before Ronald Reagan passed the Drug Reform Act, Recovery Act in 1986, right? 1985, in state prisons, you had something like 21,000 plus whites, 16,600 blacks, right? You go a decade after Reagan passes the drug recovery law, and suddenly you've got something like 146,000 African Americans, 96,000 white. That it completely reverses and morphs because of the way the discriminatory laws around cocaine and crack, but it's also the rise of notions of zero tolerance, right? I had a little nephew, seven, in school. Some kid kept hitting him, hit him three times, he told the teacher. The next time the kid hit him back, they fought. Both of them get suspended, right, for 10 days. Now, because of zero tolerance laws. These
seven-year-old kid.
Yeah, seven-year-old kid, yeah. Yeah,
the kid, first grade?
What would that be, second grade?
First, whatever.
Whatever, yeah, you know, it doesn't matter. The point being that these zero tolerance laws, right, in their essence have a racial edge to them. And it's in every aspect of our society now. We are not motivated by a sense of caring, forgiveness. We're motivated by, get 'em.
No, no, I think you're right. I think it's a much more inhumane view of the world than 30 years ago.
And so when you add the racial edge to that, because these things always play out differently racially, right? You see that it becomes very difficult to sustain a social movement in that context. Yeah. One, the resources go down. I mean, the recession of 1979, right? Followed by the recession in 1981. These things devastate African Americans' communities. And one of the things you begin to see, just at a very basic social level, right, is that a community that was known for a very vibrant civil society in terms of, say, athletics. Some, you and I both love basketball. Mm-hmm. Support for a lot of recreational basketball leagues, which kids were engaged in, and we can talk the merits of sports versus academia at another point. Yeah. But these were meaningful things in the community that the community supported. Church groups supported. We can go on to all other kinds of social networks. But when you begin to devastate the economy and you see the number of people who lose their homes, lost their jobs, they don't have money then to put into these social networks. So then you end up with communities that no longer have that vibrant civil society, and you end up with the individual and the state.
I know exactly what you mean. Actually, I think baseball more than basketball has been the casualty because the costs are higher, and African Americans had a very rich history in baseball.
That's
and
right.
It's been pretty much decimated in the last 25 years. I mean, just barely exists anymore compared to what it was 50 years ago.
Not even 50 years ago, 30 years ago.
No, it's extraordinary change, and I think that's where you see it. Well, you know, we've only got a few minutes left, Cindy Adichajewa, to talk about Black Power, the upcoming conference, March 29th to April 1st, here at the University of Illinois, Race, Roots, and Resistance, Revisiting the Legacies of Black Power. Let's talk about going forward. How do we get out of the nadir? Well, I mean, I know, knowing where you're coming from politically, which is the same place I'm coming from, that's sort of the main topic on my mind all the time. And when you're looking, talking to your students and your friends and thinking about it, looking in the mirror, how do we get it so we're not having the same conversation 10 years from today?
Well, see, one of the reasons we're having this conference is that we actually do believe that there are strategies and tactics and modes of organization that came out of Black Power that we can grab. We're not talking about taking something and bringing it as it was into the future, but we're talking about taking something that gives us the basis to redevelop some things. And so some of the things that come out of Black Power, right, is building multiracial coalitions. Some of the things that I would argue that we can take out of Black Power and pull forward is community organizing as opposed to mobilization. You know, I talked briefly about the Gary Convention and how that convention was brought about through a year or more of mass meetings in the community with delegations coming from each state, and you're bringing something like 5,000 people to Gary as elected delegates, right? In order to do that, you have to have a high level of organization. Now, contrast that with this silliness that was released a couple of Sundays ago by Tavis Smiley and this group of public intellectuals where the 25 or so of them got together and thought up a covenant, right, which is supposed to be the equivalent of a Black Freedom Agenda, that process, so few people involved, Mm-hmm. Right? That we have to go back to a process that tries to involve the masses of African American people. See, one of the traditions that survived Africa was a tradition of mass democracy. And if you look at African American politics up through the civil rights movement, right, up through the civil rights movement, I'm talking about from the slave era on through the Reconstruction, when there was major issues, the community came together and you were able to have a discussion and a vote. And what that meant in very practical terms is that working class black people could put checks mm-hmm. on the black petty bourgeoisie and their machinations because it was a collective decision making. And that's how you get Montgomery, right? Mm-hmm. Montgomery emerges as a mass-based thing. The preachers are opposed. They're forced to come on board. And you see that over and over and over throughout African-American history. That process, that commitment to mass-based participatory democracy has to be rebuilt, and that's a legacy from black power. And moving
toward it's a legacy that, not just for African-American people. It's a legacy for everyone.
True, true. The notion of the public sphere, public square in U.S. mass politics reflects the same thing. But building that kind of broad base puts us in a position, right, to have a social movement that can begin to move and press for necessary reforms and push further toward the broad-based social transformation that we lead, that we need. So there's no easy answer, but there are mechanisms, modes of struggle that we can build on.
We've only got about a minute or so left. I mean, are there hopeful signs that you put people doing stuff or organizations or groups now that sort of maybe aren't get the total answer, but right. things to say, okay, this is some people sort of, this is exciting what's happening here. I like what I'm seeing.
Down on the ground, I think some of the organizing you saw by this union group led by Curtis Muhammad in New Orleans around Katrina mm-hmm. certainly represents some of the things that we would want to look for. It laid forth a very, an outstanding critique about rebuilding the city. The Black Radical Congress, certain chapters, but more important than their actual on-the-ground work is their intellectual work. Mm-hmm. The Black Freedom Agenda that they put together, I think, should be the basis for which we begin these kinds of conversations about how to move forward. You've got a lot of things happening in African-American society where you, it's not organizations, it's the initiative of individuals.
Mm-hmm. And on that note, I want to say that the show is just drawing to an end. If you're interested in these issues, I mean, this the place to be is March 29th to April 1st at the conference at the Illini Union, the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, Race, Roots, and Resistance, Revisiting the Legacies of Black Power, talking about its legacy and its importance for today, the lessons to be learned. Our guest today on Media Matters, it's been wonderful to have you today, has been Professor Sundiata Chajua. Sundiata, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.
All right.